Are dents and scratches putting a dent in your day? Introducing Roger Steen Crash Repairs Adelaide, your trusted solution for automotive woes. With over two decades of expertise, Roger Steen Crash Repairs guarantees top-notch service, restoring your vehicle to its former glory in no time. From minor dings to major collisions, our skilled technicians handle it all with precision and care, using state-of-the-art equipment and techniques.
Roger Steen Crash Repairs saved my car. It looks brand new.
Fast, friendly and reliable. I wouldn't trust anyone else with my vehicle. Don't let accidents slow you down. Visit Roger Steen Crash Repairs Adelaide at 14 Penner Avenue, Glynde, for quality service you can count on. And here's a special offer just for our listeners. Mention this podcast and receive a $100 discount on your repair. Roger Steen Crash Repairs Adelaide. Excellence in every repair.
Past players. Past legends. Past legends.
Tonight, we're pleased to welcome Rick Darling to the show. 98 first class games, 5,554 runs, average of 35, 14 test matches, 697 runs with a high score of 91, average of 26, gun cover fielder as well, grew up at Ramco, the dashing blonde-haired bombshell. Welcome aboard, Rick.
Good morning. Good morning. Good afternoon, guys.
G'day, mate. Thanks for joining us. Doing a little bit of research on some of your statistics. And like with most of our guests, we'd like to find out where you grew up. And I see Wakerees on the list.
Yeah, well, it could go back even further than that. Ramco's a little sort of settlement, 4 or 5 Ks downstream from Waker. It's a fruit-growing settlement. And that's where I spent most of my childhood. And learning how to play cricket.
And Rick, there was footy involved as well as a youngster as well, wasn't there? Was there a choice there originally?
Not originally. There wasn't a choice, but as I got older become a young man, football was taking over from cricket as an enjoyment and as a sport, but. In those days, fathers had the final say of what you did and what you couldn't do. And I remember a time when Dad was on the phone to Foss Williams, of all people. Now, most people would know Foss.
Yep.
And there was a bit of a heated conversation between the two of them. Hence to say that I remained a cricketer and not a footballer, but always football was my first love, and I wish I had the opportunity to take it further. But you know, I was still only a skinny kid at 17, and didn't really muscle up, if you like, until a lot later. So I would have been an easy target for the halfbacks and the big burly blokes of the SANFL.
And did Ramco have a junior team that you're involved in, or did you have to travel to play some of your junior cricket?
Oh, no, there wasn't. There was no such thing as junior cricket. Even as I progressed into the Wakery ranks, there was still wasn't any opportunity to play junior cricket. You just had to bide your time and go to practice, go to the men's practice, if you like, try and work out with them. And look, if they were short or they thought you were good enough, you would get a game. So, but yeah, unfortunately, unlike my city friends and so on, there was nothing at all to keep you interested, if you like, in cricket until you started playing with the men.
Of course, then you moved down to Salisbury. Who were your first influences at Salisbury? Was Clacker Clark there then? And just trying to think, Trevor Pearson,
yeah,
Fang Kaws, etc.
That's right.
And Brattles. Salisbury was such a strong club and a lot of old, really positive older influences as well.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. Look, I went to Salisbury. You might remember, and I don't know whether they still have them, Junior Shell Shield, yep. They called it,
yep.
Where each district club had a junior team and there were two country teams. Anyhow, I played for this country team for a couple of years, and a fellow by the name of Ernie Clifton.
Yes.
He was the state coach at the time, and he got hold of me and said, "Look, come and play for Salisbury. You know, it's going to be really the only stepping stone you can take to a higher level." So anyhow, I went to play at Salisbury, spent a season or so playing in the C grade, B grade, and before I started playing A grade with, as you says, a pretty good contingent of good players. And prior to that, that was probably
71, and then you played state Colts, yep.
Yeah, the mid-70s when I started first playing A grade for Salisbury. And look, prior to that, the Salisbury club started in 65 or 66, I think it was, and they were considered really the easy beats, yep. for probably 10 years until they had a bit of a recruitment drive, if you like. Clacker Clark came, yep. into the side, Gary Wright, Wayne Pryor was started playing A grade the first time I did. Fellas like the stalwarts of the club, Barry Corsby, Brad Brook, Harvey Jolly sort of came along a little bit later, as did, yep. Glenn Bishop, but Tapper Pearson, and we had a pretty good bowling attack there, and yeah. I don't know whether you remember Dennis Schuller. Dennis, yes. Schuller came, yep. down from Queensland for one, yeah. or two seasons, and him and Wayne Pryor, plus Clacker Clark, plus Tapper Pearson, you know, to head up the bowling attack was probably the main reason that really kick-started Salisbury into not the easy beats, but the reverse of the, yeah. easy beats. And
golden era where...
It was. And I think after then, it was, after that time when they started to establish themselves, there was, I think, the 15 seasons we won 9 premierships, you know. So instead of being the easy beats, we were the benchmark.
Oh, and it did. It was quite remarkable. We, a bit of mucking around, but you think, oh, we'll book those seats, see you again next year's finals at Adelaide Oval. And, yeah, we're back again. And the inner belief, and I'll still never forget, okay, it was a little bit after your time in that regard, but the bigger inner belief I've ever seen in a side was the grand final where Nobsey made 200 for West Torrens. Yeah. And, you know, I was with Bish on the Saturday night afterwards, and 100 overs, it's only 4 and over, Malcolm. We'll bat them, we'll get them, and out walked that young Darren Lehman kid, you know, at 16, and got 80-odd not out for Salisbury to win, chasing 400. And I firmly believe no other side would have got within a bull's roar of that with not, yes. having the inner belief. And I always really admired Salisbury in that regard, and that sort of in that era, you know. And Sleepy was just unbelievable.
Well, Sleepy and a lot of the younger players started to come through, as we mentioned, Harvey Jolly, the Bishop brothers, if you like. Yes, and Sleepy, of course, was, you know, he was one of the best cricketers I've seen, as for being an all rounder. So look, yeah, from humble beginnings, if you like, from 65 through to probably 2000 and beyond, you know, Salisbury will become the benchmark.
I was going to ask, obviously, being a young fella out in the country there, sort of having to be involved with the men's program, so to speak, it sounds like it held you in pretty good stead when you arrived at Salisbury.
Yes, although we in the country there wasn't anything such like turf wickets or anything like that. It's all hard wickets, and all of a sudden you have to come down and play on the turf, which is, you know, it's one of those things you had just had to do if you wanted to progress. So yeah, it was a hard. Well, I think I found the hardest thing from coming down, from Wakery to Salisbury every week. And after a year or so, my father and mother sort of realised that I had to really live down there to progress. And that was probably the worst thing they could ever do, because all I wanted to do was go home and get on the water skis and play football and do all the things that you shouldn't be allowed to do. But the hardest thing that I found, other than being so young, was homesickness. And now that probably sounds a bit soft, but if you had the idyllic upbringing that I had in the country, doing country things, it's pretty hard not to get homesick.
I think it's just a different lifestyle, and you're right, some kids struggle to adapt and adjust,
and it still happens these days.
Yeah, and there's not a problem with that. I just think, some kids, you're right, the water and out and about's the big in thing, and struggle with the more claustrophobic living of down in the city, that side
correct.
Of things.
Correct. Yeah, and that's one thing I found, particularly when they sent me down to college, PAC, for a short stint under the guidance, if you like, of Chester Bennett. Now, everybody can relate to Chester Bennett with the Chapel Boys. Now, I mentioned in my book that nobody ever gave me any advice on technique or what I should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing.
It's extraordinary.
And that really included Chester Bennett and the rest of the so-called coaches around the place. That nobody, apart from being a practice captain or practice captains, nobody has really passed on any of their knowledge or any of their
expertise,
any advice, if you like.
Yeah, I found that extraordinary reading your book, Rick, and I was going to bring that up a little bit later. And even now, as we said, there was you and I at that game down at West Torrens, and ironically, you'd said to Hags, and then I said it to Hags 2 minutes later about where Drew's grip's gone wrong. And you come back and go, what in the hell, where's the coaching at the moment? And still right back. And
mentorship.
But back then, I think too, and look, Ian was fantastic, but probably Ian, the one weakness about Ian was, it was very much sink or swim. You were thrown in the deep end, and like you and Hooksy did in terms of your Shield side in 75, 76, which we're going to get to in a minute, you were very much thrown in, and, well, you're the two kids. You get on with it, listen, learn, and that was about, it wasn't really mentorship. It was sort of you watch, see what we do, and get on with it.
Yeah, that's right. There wasn't any sitting down in a room and going through a game plan or anything like this. And as I mentioned there, there wasn't and I just can't believe it, that the support they've got these days compared with the support we had.
Yeah,
we had nobody apart from even I was thinking of team managers. We used to travel just with the team only and a team manager. The team manager was supposed to be the sort of the semi-coach, if you like, for the tour. But and Hooksy would have testified to this, that none of us got any help at all. You just had to rely on your own devices, your own talent. And get on with it, and it's just a big difference to what they've got today.
And you had your success with the South Australian Colts in 74-75, which was a real big thing back then. Colts selection generally led to SA selection, yeah, which it was. Yeah. And you made 100 against Victoria, some runs against the West Indies and WA, and that led to your Shield debut. And sort of you were down the order. And I know it'll amaze there are people out there. Rick's first innings, he was run out. We will get into the run outs at some stage.
I did hear about that one.
Yes. And, but where you didn't make a huge number of runs that year in terms of that, but you really contributed your timing of getting runs and even a 30 against WA to get us home. You played a big part in South Australia winning the Shield that year. And as a South Australian fanatic person, we don't get to say those words very often, Rick.
I just missed you there for a minute.
We don't win many Shields in South Australia, and you contributed significantly at vital times in 75-76. Both you and Hooksy batted generally 5 and 6, and were a big part of the Shield win though.
Under the leadership of Ian Chappell, of course, you know, it was a really good initiation for myself and Hooksy. Hooksy started playing, I think, in November of that season, and I started playing, I think, in about January. And look, although we didn't really set the world on fire with big scores, you know, we contributed.
Yes.
You know, and that's one thing that I sort of carried with me right through my career is that, you know, I didn't make a lot of really big scores, but I was happy if I contributed to a win or contributed to a big score. That season was, and everybody pitched in, of course, as you do when you win a Shield or a Grand Final or whatever sport you're playing. Everybody chips in, and it's quite an harmonious sort of atmosphere.
And it was, to win the Shield. Look, so I'm 13. So I'm 13 then, as you know, Rick, fanatic at Shield games.
Yes.
Yeah, remember that. Admittedly, 81-82 bigger memories, but I do remember just the vital contributions. That was more the point there. And then, so 76-77, you made your first 100 against Victoria, mate.
Yes, I'm a... you sort of got me a little bit. I struggle with dates and when things were and whatever these days. But that was in Melbourne, I assume.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I should remember all this, but I don't. So
that's
you might have to help me out. So
that's all right.
Yeah. I remember. In fact, I think I've got a photograph here of Alan Hurst bowling at his best, and myself hooking it. Strangely enough. For four, so good memories, and also, you know, a good milestone, if you like, to, you know, to actually to make 100 on the MCG, and you know, back then you used to get a quite a decent crowd to the to Shield games, you know, and obviously you wouldn't fill up the MCG, but at Bay 13 was a big thing.
I even think back here where it was the dollar day on the Sunday. I remember when we played Queensland, when both of them played, and I reckon there was about 10,000 on the Sunday,
we only
get 10,000 less now, Rick.
9,999. Yeah. Mate, obviously, Malcolm and I have talked about this at length during our normal episodes, in that a lot of the touring teams don't play any lead-up games, but in your debut season, you got to play against the West Indies. What was that feeling like playing against an international team as part of their warm-up?
Oh, it's not only good for their warm-up, it gave us an extra first-class game to, you know, to play against a better team for the 4 days. And, you know, plus you could, I'm not saying you could, if you had any weaknesses, you could probably experiment on them, but you know, it's not the really stage for that. But look, yeah, I mean, looking back on that, that was, I thought it was probably, well, if I can go back even further, you know, a touring team would come to, let's say they'd come to Adelaide. They would play the South Australian team on that weekend, if you like, for over the 4 days. Then they would travel to the country and they would play an SA country team.
That's right, yeah.
Normally in a big country centre. I mean, my dad used to, he played in them, and Renmark, Mount Gambier, rings a bell, Port Lincoln, and all these bigger country towns would host the touring side for 1 or 2 days, and then there'll be a test match. So on the following weekend. So,
and they generally had played at Lilac Hill at WA first, WA, right. WA, and quite often in WA country as well. And I've got a real beef now with the programming. As we know, it's all 2020 based, and we could go on and have another episode on that side of it, where cricket's at. But there was no doubt the touring sides were prepared for ball one of a test match, where nowadays they're not. I actually, you know, Pakistan is still adjusting now, and it's the third test. It's crazy.
Yeah, I am.
Yep, that's all right. So we're just dropping in and out a little bit. Yeah, so, you know, sides now, you're still adjusting when the series is over, which is ridiculous. It's just, you know, I'm just so angry where test cricket is at now with, you know, the Indian board taking over and all that, which we could go on and on about that.
Yeah,
it's a real worry of the concern of the game. Now, Rick, you came through, and then so when World Series started, you actually started as 12th man in that year and then came through.
Made it
runs against WA, making 100, then 100 against Tasmania in a one-day game to put your name about. So your pick for the test match here to open with Graham Wood. Was 21, you were 20.
Yes.
And you did very well in that game. You put on 89 for the first wicket, best opening patch of the series. You made 65 and then 56. And I reckon, too, people forget that test match was a six-day test match, too, which was very unusual. It went through. Oh. Tomo got injured, did his hammy, and Clark from WA and Ian Mad Dog Callan. That was the only test match he played.
Yeah.
And we came through and we won it on that extra day.
6 days. And
So,
well, and that. You got me there. I didn't realise.
Oh, well, there are Warwick Maxwell. I do help occasionally. So, yeah.
I didn't realise that was a six-dayer, but okay.
And it was a great game. It fluctuated back and forth. You know, Gavaskar playing, et cetera, and Bobby Simpson. You know, Simpson, the 10-year gap, came back and did very well in that series too.
He did.
Made 200s. So go through that experience, Rick, and really getting up to win the series in that test match. It would have been a huge buzz winning that game.
Well, it was because that was just not only my first test match, it was my initiation, if you like, to the next level.
Yeah.
Plus the fact it was an exciting time because we not only won the test, in the next 2 or 3 days we had to jet off to the West Indies, which was another great experience for me, for a country lad who's never been outside of the state, basically, particularly Australia. It was quite a buzz, and getting to the West Indies was a bit of a chore back in those days. So it was about a 4 or 5 day jaunt to get there. So it's not so much the cricket that I remember. It's more the events that happen around the cricket and the camaraderie. And in fact, on the back of my book, it's words to the effect that Bobby Simpson quoted years ago. I think it was in the West Indies. He said that he said that Look, you won't remember your sort of on-field experiences, but what you will remember is the places you've been in, the comma, yeah, and the friends you've made. Now that's sort of stuck in my mind, and it's dead true. You know, I struggle remembering where and when I played and how many runs I made or whatever, but you know, we talk about a night out with the boys and you know, just being with your mates is something I'll always remember.
Well, you do mention there in your book where you know you've turned 21 on that tour, and probably Dutch Courage came in during the night. You may have gone to a spot in the West Indies where it probably wasn't really advisable to be, and walked in and quickly got back on the bus and then kicked on further, and then more Dutch Courage came in with more alcohol consumed, obviously. And
Yeah.
Not there. So that was quite an entertaining reading there in your book too there, Rick, which the book is called Bush to Buckingham Palace. You can certainly get it at any good bookstore. It's available at Dillon's, next to my book, The Definitive Rule Book, actually. We're next door to each other there, Rick. So there are some copies there, and I was in Dillon's today. So anyone there, $33, call into Dillon's and that as well, and other good bookstores around the tracks, Rick.
I'm glad you gave it a plug, because I was going to ask where can we get it, but you've got it all sussed out.
Yes. Well, if I can, obviously it's, at Dillon's, as you say, but probably the best way of getting it is Google Ryan Publishing in Melbourne.
Yeah.
It's a simple phone call to Graham Ryan, who's the boss of the company, obviously, and he will send you one out straight away, and it'll be there on your desk in 2 days. So
that's
the way we are trying to sell it. Publish, you know, get his name and number out, and the buyer can sort of take it from there. But,
Rick is a guest speaker at a function. We will put this on our page as well, Pete, on the test match on the Tuesday before the test match starting on the Wednesday. Tuesday the 16th of January at Adelaide Lutheran Footy Club on South Terrace, corner of South and West Terrace. Anyone's welcome. There's no charge to get in. It's Adelaide Lutheran there. It's a good old-fashioned footy club, almost a bit of a country feel, the Lutheran club there. Barbecue on the night. You buy your barbecue, you buy your drinks, and, Rick will be interviewed and obviously have books for sale and signing the books that night as well. And anyone is welcome, and, they can certainly respond on our page if they're going to attend, or on the Footy Almanac site as well, where it's up there on the Footy Almanac site. So,
I've done a few of those. I'm looking forward to the Lutheran Club, because there's supposed to be a fair number of people that have not promised to come along, but have said they're interested. And I've done similar promos, as they say. It's not a launch. We had a launch 12 months ago, but these promos, if you like, I did one in Melbourne, one in the Barossa, and somewhere else. And it was really for the Footy Almanac people. So they've been quite small crowds, whereas the one at the Lutheran Club, I expect, you know, to
Hopefully we'll get good numbers there. Don't worry, I'm hammering the hell out of it, and the response so far has been reasonably encouraging. So don't worry, I'll keep going on that one, Rick. So anyway, back on your side of it there. On the West Indies tour, you also had problems with illness a bit as well. So your form, illness and injury fluctuated as a bit. You also kept in a game against the Windward Islands and that. So you're back and forth and that. And also probably there, I reckon, in your career, it was never really worked out whether you would have opened or batted in the middle order. And I think that probably affected your career a little bit there as well, Rick, where it was said nerves played a part in you opening. But you know, I think you're a fantastic player of spin. I would have loved to have seen you bat more in the middle order as well, but we'll never know on that one, Rick.
Well, that's I never really, really enjoyed the game because I didn't really enjoy the game because of of everybody thought I was an opener, and continued to think I was an opener and made me open when I didn't really want to open. I was thrown into it years before when it was on a trip to Perth, the Sheffield Shield trip, and Les Favell was manager, Ian Chappell captain, of course, and they got together and says, well, you know, let's see what this guy can do as an opener. And fortunately, I went out, and I'm not sure how many I got. I couldn't tell you, but I contributed. I contributed to our win. We had a big chase, I think, on the second innings, and I contributed to that. I've lost my train of thought now.
Yeah, I think you then just ended up opening where, I thought you were a great player at spin bowling, and always personally thought you were better suited to batting five or six, but that was my opinion and that sort of thing.
And you're right. As a budding schoolboy, if you like, coming through the ranks, I always batted, you know, five, six, or seven, and had. If I can go just back a step, when I first came down from the river, I was classified as a leg spin bowler who could bat.
Do remember that, Rick? Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Who could bat a little bit, and then one game changed that altogether, and I got it was a schoolboys game. I got smacked around when I was bowling, but ended up making 50. And from that day on, I was considered a batsman who couldn't bowl. Now, for so-called coaches and managers and that to throw me around like that and make that decision on one performance was something I just can't get my head around. And I would have enjoyed the game a lot more if I was allowed to continue bowling or particularly being an all-rounder rather than just a batsman. So, I agree with you, Malcolm. I enjoyed batting middle order much more than opening. Opening is fulfilling, you know, if you can, you know, obviously if you get runs. But being an opener, you're only, you know, getting runs is bloody hard to do. You know, you try and get a score every two, maybe three, maybe four innings. But when you do make that score, you've got to make it a big score. Whereas, you know, batting middle order, and I thought I was all right against the spin, it just didn't happen because I was earmarked as an opener, and that's where I stood for most of my career.
But Rick Darling, part one, fantastic to have Rick on board, and just going through some of his exploits there, coming from Wakeree or, you know,
Ramco
and obviously making his way to South Australia in the cricket as well.
Yeah, and playing at Salisbury, as we said, and we covered that with Rick, with Clacker Clark and Pearson and Fang and the Jollies, and et cetera, the seniority really helping the kid as he arrived and going through and being a significant feature in a couple of, you know, Shield wins for South Australia. Unfortunately, he didn't have as productive a test career as he would have liked. Injuries certainly played a part there.
Yep.
You know, we did cover where he very nearly died at Adelaide Oval, batting against Bob Willis in the test match there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right, and part two coming up, obviously, next week. So we thank Rick for his time.